Good morning. On today's programme, how the leather industry is polluting the Ganges River in India, a legal challenge to Canada's ban on single-use plastics, and Prague recalls the church bells seized by the Nazis. But first we go to London, and this past week marks a year since the Taliban took control of the Afghan capital Kabul. It also marks 1 year since the Kabul airlift, when the US, Britain and other allies evacuated Afghans who'd helped them during the war. As Kabul fell, CNN's Alicia Lloyd reported on the evacuation of Afghans to the UK, meeting with one refugee, Fakria, as she and her husband arrived in London. 1 year later, she checked in to see how they're getting on.
1 year. 1 year since Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. 1 year since girls stopped going to school. 1 year of harrowing fear for those who helped the British military during the war and were left behind. And for the lucky ones who did get out, 1 year of life here in the UK. And while they may have escaped a nightmare in Afghanistan, many of them are now living through another one. Over 9,000 Afghans have spent the past year trapped in hotels. Human Rights Watch warns that many are suffering serious mental health issues. The government has rehoused 7,000, but is now encouraging those who are still in hotels to seek accommodation themselves on housing websites like Rightmove and Zoopla. A tough task, even for those with the language, the means and the necessary paperwork. For their part, the Home Office says they will continue to move people into more sustainable accommodation as quickly as possible. Last year, for this programme, I spoke to Fakria. She escaped Afghanistan with her husband as part of the Shevening Scholarship Programme for UK universities. It had gained attention after prominent politicians raised their case with the Prime Minister. At the time, she told me about their harrowing journey. She was quarantining in a hotel and told me she felt on the verge of a mental breakdown. 1 year later, and Fakria is still in a hotel. She is at pains to tell me how grateful she is, though. We have been provided every facility here in the hotel. Very thankful for that. We feel safe compared to back home. I've been telling everyone that what I love the most is the people. They're very kind and helpful. While she and her husband wait to be housed, next week they'll be shifted to another hotel, away from London. That's difficult, as Fakria had been studying at London's Queen Mary University, so now she'll be separated from the friends she worked hard to make. Fakria gave birth to a baby son 2 months ago. It's now more important than ever that they get proper housing. She tells me it's hard to handle a newborn in a hotel, a place which is not a home. She says they're managing, though. We have no other option. And Fakria tells me she's praying it won't take another year for them to get housing. I'm hoping for a safe and happy life and a bright future for my son, inshallah. Meanwhile, thousands of Afghans who worked for the UK remain at risk in the country. Government figures show more than 20,000 have been resettled in the UK, but it's believed between 75 and 150,000 have applied for evacuation. It's estimated only 5% of those received assistance. A coalition of human rights groups briefed Parliament earlier this month, telling them the British government's resettlement schemes are unjustifiably restrictive. British organisations who worked with Afghans to deliver the aims of the British mission even called the schemes needlessly mean. The Home Office says, we continue to work at pace to assist people facing serious risk in Afghanistan. And the Foreign Office reminds us they've helped 20,000 people to leave the country. Fakria tells me of her family in Afghanistan. They are just living helplessly. I am very worried about them all, especially about my niece's school and education. I miss everything about my country. Though I have everything here in the UK that a happy life can have, if my country gets stable again, I may move back. But Taliban-controlled Afghanistan is in dire straits. Millions are facing famine. It is a grave humanitarian crisis. Fakria's wish to go back, a very distant dream. For World Report, this is Alicia Lloyd in London.
Next to Prague and the story of a 9,801 kilogram bell cast in the Austrian city of Innsbruck to remember the 9,801 bells seized by the Nazis from towers and church steeples in Czechoslovakia during the war. The bell will be installed on the island in Prague, where the bells were collected in 1942 and sent to Germany to be melted down for weapons. From Prague, Rob Cameron reports.
The black and white photos are remarkable. In fields by the River Vltava, a sprawling graveyard of bells arranged in solemn rows of metal, huge bells, small bells, lined up and scrawled with numbers and initials in chalk. Here and there, a Czech worker stands next to them, photographed with an impenetrably neutral expression, perhaps one of disbelief. The 9,801 bells, 90% of the country's wartime total, had been hoisted down from town halls and village churches across the Nazi protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, loaded onto trains and diesel trucks and set down here on Rohansky Ostrov, an island in the capital, on orders of the German occupiers. From there, they were loaded onto barges and taken down the River Vltava, the Moldau in German, and onto the River Elbe, all the way to Hamburg, where they were melted down, presumably to make munitions for Hitler's war effort. Sadly, the practice was something of a wartime tradition for Europe. It happened during the First World War and in previous wars, bronze being so valuable and freely available in church steeples and town halls everywhere. The same thing happened in the Second World War, but this time what followed was 4 decades of an atheist communist regime who had little interest in replacing them. Even today, many bells have never been replaced. To mark their loss, a group of Czech bell ringers and bell enthusiasts have got together and launched a unique initiative to create a huge bell weighing 9,801 kilograms to remember the bells requisitioned by the Nazis. Instead of 9,801 little memorials, so many silenced voices will be remembered with a single powerful voice which will speak for them, in the words of the chief organiser. Around 75% of the costs have already been raised by donations. Organisers hope to reach 100% by the time the bell is transported to Prague in late August. It was cast in Austria because the craft of bell making has largely died out in the Czech Republic. There are small foundries, but casting a 10,000 kilo bell was beyond them. So this one has been produced by Austria's famous Grassmeyer foundry, and will soon be ringing out on the banks of the River Vltava. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
To Canada next, where a group of plastics manufacturers are heading to court to try to stop the federal government's plan to ban single-use plastic items. Regulations for the ban were made in June, and the ban is set to begin unrolling in December. It's the second court challenge to the ban. The first is still before the courts. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, Canada's Environment Minister says he's confident that this new legal challenge won't succeed.
The filing in federal court in Ottawa was made by a group of producers calling themselves the Responsible Plastic Use Coalition. Their challenge is a call on the federal court for a judicial review of the ban. In addition, they want the regulations that would implement the ban torn up. The Canadian government's ban would see the end of the manufacture, sale, and import of takeout containers, stir sticks, retail carryout bags, cutlery, and most straws. In 2020, Ottawa's scientific assessment concluded that plastic is ubiquitous in the environment. Researchers estimated that about 29,000 tons of plastic waste wound up in the environment in 2016 alone. That assessment also concluded that plastics degrade very slowly, so the frequency of plastic pollution in the environment is expected to increase. It also concluded that macroplastics, those that are bigger than 5 millimeters, can lead to physical harm in natural areas, with animals becoming injured and dying after eating or becoming entangled in plastic waste. Scientists say turtles, whales, and seabirds are often affected. In 2019, a dead baby turtle in Florida was found to have more than 100 pieces of plastic in its stomach. In 2018, a dead sperm whale in Indonesia had 6 kilograms of plastic garbage in its stomach. Researchers still aren't sure of the impact of microplastics, pieces less than 5 millimeters. They aren't sure if they can kill or cause developmental or reproductive problems, and more research is being called for on that front. A study in Canada found that less than 10% of plastic waste generated by Canadians is recycled. That translates into 3.3 million tons of plastic waste every year, specifically 15.5 billion plastic grocery bags, 4.5 billion pieces of plastic cutlery, 3 billion stir sticks, and nearly 6 billion straws. The Responsible Plastic Use Coalition argues that, in fact, there is no credible evidence that any of the single-use plastics are toxic, and therefore the ban cannot be justified under criminal law. The coalition wants the ban put on hold until there is a decision whether or not to quash it completely. That's likely a reference to the first lawsuit brought by the coalition. It was filed last year and was intended to overturn Ottawa's decision to list plastic pollution as toxic under the Environmental Protection Act. That lawsuit is still before the courts. The designation of toxic is needed for the government to ban substances that are thought to be harmful to human, animal, or environmental health. Canada's Environment Minister, Stephen Guilbeault, says the coalition can do what it wants in court, but he believes it will lose, adding that the government will stick to the facts which show clearly that plastic pollution is harming the environment. And there is growing evidence that Canadians are on side with the ban. Government statistics show that many people are moving away from single-use plastics. They're using fewer disposable straws and instead relying on reusable bags and water bottles. In a survey last year, 20% of Canadian households reported using plastic drinking straws, compared to 23% just a couple of years before that. And nearly every household surveyed said they were using their own bags or containers when grocery shopping. More than half said this was done all the time. Retail operators are also joining in or even moving faster than the government. Canadian Walmart stores no longer provide single-use plastic bags, and Loblaws says it will eliminate the single-use shopping bags by early 2023. Environment Minister Guilbeault says the government is all in when it comes to reducing plastic pollution, and it's open to adding more items to the banned list at some point. He said Canada can't ban its way out of the plastic waste problem, adding that it's part of the solution. But he also plans to regulate companies who produce plastics to use more and more recycled plastic as part of the content in their products. Ottawa is hoping to eliminate all plastic waste from ending up in landfills or in the environment by 2030. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchak in Toronto.
Finally, we go to India and the city of Kanpur, which is located on the Ganges River and is famous for its leather industry. The industry has been producing leather goods since the mid-19th century, with most of its products sent to Europe and the United States. But pollution from the tanneries is threatening to destroy the wildlife and ecology around the river, and is being blamed for sickness and life-threatening illnesses, as Sandeep Kumar reports from India.
Kanpur is a densely populated city famous for its leather industries. The city produces an estimated 450 million litres of municipal sewage and industrial effluent daily, a majority of which was flowing directly into the Holi River until recently. The pollution from the Kanpur tanneries is destroying the ecology of the local Ganges River and scarring residents in the form of life-threatening illnesses. The city of Kanpur lies on the banks of the Ganges River in northern India. It has become one of the most important cities in India as its leather industry has grown. First established in the mid-19th century, Kanpur is now the country's biggest producer of leather products. Its leather is exported across the world, with 95% of its output destined for Western markets, including those in the US, UK and Germany. According to the local farmer, this water is channeled onto local farmland, poisoning the soil, entering the food chain and accumulating in local ecosystems. The city is now notorious for having some of the country's worst water pollution problems, yet the tannery industry continues to discharge wastewater laced with toxic chemicals, such as chromium, freely into local waterways. At greatest risk are the people who work in the tanneries and farmers who work daily with the toxic and highly acidic water. Local residents suffer an array of health troubles, a result of the bioaccumulation of dangerous toxins over decades. Health problems include cancers, child development issues and skin diseases. India's rapid growth over the past 30 years has seen its economy emerge as one of the largest and most important in the world. But this breakneck development is coming at great cost as pollution from a wide range of industries is leaving a toxic trail on the environment and general populace. Millions are poisoned and killed each year, others have reduced neurological development, damaged immune systems, and long-term health problems. The number of people affected is comparable to those affected by HIV/AIDS, according to the Blacksmith Institute, a non-profit that studies solutions to problems caused by toxic pollution. The wide-ranging environmental impacts of these pollutants range from bioaccumulation of toxins in ecosystems to long-term contamination of farmland. The subsequent toll on human health appears in the form of increased prevalence of cancers, birth defects, and numerous other life-threatening illnesses. For World Report, this is Sandeep Kumar in Kanpur, India.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.